We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What a less than inspiring week this has been.
Well,
are you talking about the elections, Mike?
Yeah, primarily the elections.
Well, that kind of depends which races you're paying attention to, because it was actually kind of a mixed bag this year. But yeah, the three headline races in Seattle are all pretty discouraging, although one of them is pulling a lot closer than people realize right now, and we'll talk about that in a minute. First, there was the mayoral candidate. Well, no, let's take it in the order of what appeared on the ballot. So
for King County executive.
Well, first of all, I wanted to talk about the unexpectedly close race for advisory vote number 37, which was the state capital gains measure. And that was behind on election day, and that's the first time in the 10 years of this absolutely frivolous Tim Eymann-inspired ballot feature that I can remember anything failing, but it is now actually pulled ahead. So it's not going to influence the fact that the law has been passed in any way. It's not going to influence future behavior by the legislature in any way, but it was interesting that it was so close. And it is so close.
I think it showed the demographic of the early returns. So the folks who mark their ballots and mail them in ahead of time tend to be more conservative voters, probably older, more conservative voters as well, and folks who have quite a bit of means. So the folks who would be taxed under this law, probably if they voted, they voted early on. And then, of course, the demographic of the later returns, the folks who wait until the very end to cast their vote, tend to be more progressive. Those folks care about the character of the folks who they elect. And I think really kind of want to wait and see what happens in the election before they mark their ballot and mail it in. They don't want to mark their ballot and then a week later see that there's a big scandal that a candidate they voted for had, and then they feel bad about it. So I think that's a big part of it.
And that was a statewide vote. The progressive surge, which happens in every election, that tendency that Maria is talking about, was more pronounced this year than in any year I can remember. And we'll talk about that in some of these city races particularly.
Yeah.
But it really has been pronounced this year. And we'll talk about that in some of these races.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go ahead and talk about King County Executive.
So the King County races, King County Executive Dow Constantine looks like he's cruising in for re-election with an 11% lead over Joe Wynn as of Friday afternoon's results. In the King County Council District races, all of the incumbents are winning except for Kathy Lambert. And she's trailing progressive Sarah Perry by almost 12% now. She's been trailing from the start. So even the early returns folks were voting against her. So that's an interesting race there and some good news for the King County Council.
Yeah, she got in a lot of trouble over a very racist fundraising email, which we said at the time was probably a sign of desperation on behalf of her campaign. They probably had very negative internal polling, and so they were trying to rally their base, and it really backfired badly on her. So she's going to be retired after 20 years on King County Council, and it's very much addition by subtraction. Welcome to Sarah Perry.
I'd be curious who her campaign manager was that helped make the call on that.
Well, probably a standard Republican operative. Because, of course, both parties have people that recycle from campaign to campaign. And if you're on the Democratic side, they'd probably have trouble getting more work. I suspect they'll have no trouble getting work for Republican campaigns.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Now, if we go to the Port of Seattle races,
oh, goody.
Kind of the order that they appeared on the ballot, Ryan Calkins is sailing to re-election, which is good news. And then progressives Hamdi Mohamed and Toshiko Grace Hasegawa are beating the incumbents, Stephanie Bowman and Peter Steinbrück. I'm particularly happy to see Hamdi Mohamed replace Stephanie Bowman on the port. Peter was pretty good. Peter Steinbrück was pretty good on the port. I think Toshiko Grace Hasegawa will also be very good. And so change is coming to the port, if not to the rest of Seattle.
Yeah, those port races were probably the highlight of the local ballot. Mm-hmm. Very, very good news for both races.
Yeah.
Especially Bowman, as you said. She was very much part of the corruption of the Port of Seattle.
Yeah. And so it's really nice to see Hamdi Mohamed replace her. Now we're turning to those City of Seattle races that folks here really care a lot about. In the mayor's race, Bruce Harrell had an insurmountable lead in the early returns on Tuesday, and Lorena Gonzalez conceded the race by Thursday. I think it was the writing on the wall from the start there.
Yeah, he was up by 30 points on election mm-hmm. night.
Yeah.
And that is now 19, which shows you how much has shifted in the course of 3 days. And there's still ballots left to count, but that is an insurmountable lead, no question.
Yeah. And then in the two city council races, Teresa Mosqueda is cruising to re-election, and she's continuing to widen her gap against Kenneth Wilson. But I think his returns really surprised a lot of people because they were thinking, who the heck is he? You know, he barely campaigned, it seems like. But he is, you know, I think we're underestimating the down ballot effect of the negative campaigning in the mayor's race and council position 9 race. And the city attorney's race. Now, for council position 9, Nikita Oliver is trailing Sarah Nelson by 9%. That's a margin that I think she's not going to be able to overcome. I think she would have to get up to 90% of the remaining ballots in order to even get close. So I think the writing's on the wall for that we're going to see Sarah Nelson on the city council next year.
And that is highly unfortunate.
But yeah.
I think that's an insurmountable lead also. On the other hand, for city attorney,
Yes, for city attorney, the results in that race have narrowed considerably. Nicole Thomas Kennedy is now a little over 5 percentage points behind Ann Davison, closing a huge gap by taking nearly 60% of the latest ballot count. But
and
to overcome Davison's lead, she's going to need to take, I think, over 3/4 of the remaining ballots, or else turnout is going to have to have been a lot higher than I think anybody expected. And I just don't think she'll do that. She'll pull very close, but I think we're going to see Ann Davison.
Yeah, I saw a report from King County Elections that on election day, they collected 250,000 ballots from the drop boxes. And, of course, those are going to be the last to be counted. So that's a huge surge compared to past elections.
Yeah, that's interesting a lot of people didn't mail their ballots. The vast majority of them dropped them in the ballot boxes. So if turnout was higher than 60%.
I can explain that.
Yeah. If turnout was higher than 60%, she's got a chance. But if it's hovering around 55%, as a lot of people expect, I just don't think Nicole Thomas Kennedy will take the lead. But we'll
see. I mean, the math is certainly against her, but it's not out of the question. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what Monday's ballot count results are going to be. That's going to tell us a lot, because that should be a lot of the remaining ballots. To give you an idea, Davison was up by 19% on election night, and it's now 5%. That alone, even if we stop counting ballots today, that's a bigger swing than I can remember in any election primary or general.
I think Shama Sawant's biggest swing was about 13%. So to see a 14% swing in 3 days for Nicole Thomas Kennedy is amazing. And so if turnout was higher than most of the quote unquote official sources like the Seattle Times or some of the other pundits who are used to watching races around here have estimated it around 55%. If it's 60 or 65% or more, Nicole Thomas Kennedy has a real shot.
Yeah.
We'll just see.
And right now, 36% is the turnout that has been counted. So there's still a lot of ballots to go.
There's still a lot of ballots if you're thinking, you know, turnout was over 50%. So we'll see. So, yeah. So far it looks like we're going to have one incumbent, Teresa Mosqueda, and two pro-business Democrats taking the mayor's office and the open, citywide council seat. And then we'll just have to see if we get a Trump Republican as the city attorney. That could make next year very, very interesting here in city politics.
Honestly, if Thomas Kennedy somehow gets in, that's going to make things really interesting too. Yeah.
Yeah. So never a dull moment. What I want to do though is I want to look at the money spent in this year's citywide election.
One other note on that. Going forward, pay very careful attention to who Harrell appoints in his administration.
Yeah.
That's going to tell us a lot about what his mayorship is going to look like.
Yeah. So and whether or not he keeps some of the promises he made in his campaign of, you know, the first month I take office or the first day I take office or in my first year, you know, it'll be, interesting to see if he actually follows through on those promises.
Those promises were often so vague that it would be almost impossible not to follow through on them.
Yeah, but some of them were pretty specific, you know, setting up a job center and things like that. You can't make super specific promises like that and not follow through because people remember, right?
Yeah. And the conflicts between Harrell and his city council are going to be epic.
Yeah. So now let's look at the money spent in this year's city election. And I'm just going to look at first, let's just look at the overall totals. All candidates spent $6.8 million total. That's a new record, okay, for their campaigns. Independent expenditure committees and PACs spent $4.9 million, another new record. And then
an awful lot of those were for Harrell flyers that I got in the mail.
Well, I'll talk about the breakdown of those here in a minute. Adding in the $2.67 million spent on Charter Amendment 29 and so far on the Recall Sawant initiative, which is going to be on the ballot for voters in Council District 3 next month, a total of $14.4 million was spent in the city of Seattle on this year's election. So that total, again, is another new record. Among the candidates, Bruce Harrell spent the most at $1,292,700 on his campaign. He alone counts for 19% of the total.
I can remember when mayoral campaigns were considered extremely expensive when they topped $500,000. So that is just
it's a brave new world here.
It is very much a brave new world. And Harrell has set a new standard for how much money you have to raise to get in the mayor's office.
Yeah.
That's probably not good because there's really only one obvious source for that kind of money.
Yeah. Now, Lorena Gonzalez was second. She raised $994,302. Third was Sarah Nelson with $573,870. Fourth was Ann Davison at $439,238.
Which again is insane for a city attorney race.
I know. And then Nikita Oliver was fifth. She was no slouch with $435,448. Nicole Thomas Kennedy was sixth with a whopping $428,409. Again, an amazing amount for those two progressive candidates. And Teresa Mosqueda spent $306,243, with Kenneth Wilson spending just about $99,952, which is why a lot of people were asking, who's Kenneth Wilson? Because they didn't even get a flyer, you know. So.
And as in a per vote, that's one measure of, how wisely campaigns spend their money. Kenneth Wilson's looking pretty good there.
Oh, he does, yeah. Now, when it comes to number of contributors, Lorena Gonzalez takes the prize there with 11,178 individual contributors. Harrell, by comparison, Bruce Harrell had 9,313. In third place is Nikita Oliver with 5,876. Teresa Mosqueda was fourth with 5,708 contributors. Nicole Thomas Kennedy was fifth with 5,267. Ann Davison had 3,913 contributors. And trailing the pack was Sarah Nelson with just 2,143 donors. That reflects the very high dollar amounts that she received from her very wealthy contributors. On average, she had $260 per contributor, and that's the highest average for anyone on the November ballot. So she takes first place in terms of the average size of donations for to her campaign. For Harrell,
unfortunately, she's probably very proud of that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember what the threshold is for starting to receive democracy vouchers? I think that's pretty low by comparison.
She didn't take. I don't think she took.
No. I'm not talking about Nelson. I'm talking about in general. I think it's like 500 donors, something like that.
Yeah.
Because that really needs to be updated. And any citywide campaign, and these were all citywide campaigns, not district campaigns. Any citywide campaign is going to smash through that barrier very early on in the campaign now. We saw that very clearly this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, in terms of average size of donations, for Harrell, the average size was $137 per contributor, and for Gonzalez, it was $89. Okay, so there's the comparison for the mayor's race. Against Sarah Nelson, who had $260 per contributor, Nikita Oliver had $74 per contributor. So there's the Council 9 race. In Council Position 8, Teresa Mosqueda had the lowest average at $54 per contributor. Her challenger, Kenneth Wilson, also had a very high average of $181 per contributor, putting him in second place for that dubious metric, behind Sarah Nelson. And Ann Davison would be in fourth place with $112 per contributor versus $81 for Nicole Thomas Kennedy. So Sarah Nelson was number one there, Kenneth Wilson number two, Bruce Harrell number three, Ann Davison number four, and let's see who's
Once again, that tells mm-hmm. you both where their support was and mm-hmm. what their policies were like.
Oh yeah,
that's the pro business slate basically.
So, the
progressive candidates have lower on average contributors because they get contributors from average working people.
Right now the campaigns are just one side of the spending coin. The other side is the independent expenditure committees and PAC money. Okay. The totals that were spent between the primary and the November election, I'm just going to look at those only because that's the one where the vast majority of the spending was done. That's going to eliminate all those candidates that didn't make it through. Mm-hmm. Now, the number one was Harrell for Seattle's Future. They spent $865,435, 76% of which were for attack ads against Lorena Gonzalez.
That also, when you combine with Harrell's campaign, mm-hmm. means that over $2 million was spent to elect Harrell mayor.
Yep. Essential workers for Lorena.
Let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah,
staggering amount of money.
Yeah. Number two is Essential Workers for Lorena, who spent $466,000. So a little over half of what the Harrell PAC spent. $466,663. All of it was anti-Bruce Harrell. Again, more attack ads. Number three on the list is Change Seattle, the anti-Nikita Oliver PAC. $360,781. 91% of their spending were attack ads against Oliver to benefit Sarah Nelson. Okay.
And I want to know what the current reality is that they're thinking Seattle is in if they think Nikita Oliver represents where Seattle is now.
I know. I know. Yeah, she wouldn't be running for city council if that were the case. She'd be on city council. Okay. So number four on the pack list was Seattle for Common Sense. That's the anti-Nicole Thomas Kennedy one. Spent $359,483 on those attack flyers and other negative campaigning against Nicole Thomas Kennedy to benefit Ann Davison. Okay. So those are the four biggest PACs. Now, two smaller PACs also spent money to support Bruce Harrell. So he's already, what, at 2 million, right?
Yeah, I think close to 2.1.
Yeah, you're going to have to add in $193,616 spent by Seattle Firefighters PAC and the National Association of Realtors Fund to bring his total up. Okay. Because instead of attacking Gonzalez, they were advertising on his behalf. And that's a very, very important feature. And I think something that separated the two mayoral campaigns is that there was a lot of money spent to attack the opponent for Bruce Harrell, but there was also a lot of money spent to promote him as well. And we didn't see the Gonzalez campaign do nearly as good a job promoting Gonzalez.
Yeah.
In addition, her campaign made a couple of big mistakes in, first off, purchasing a whole bunch of dried cherries to mail to Seattle voters.
Oh, I didn't even hear about that one.
I got one of those mailers, and my feeling was, you know, I'm not going to do anything with these. I'm just going to throw them away and feel guilty about it. You know, whose idea was this? That was a big mistake.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, and then the second mistake they made was running a TV ad that allowed her opponent to attack her the way that he did in the last couple weeks of the campaign. And I think that's really sunk, you know, by sinking to the level of engaging in attack ads, it really opened her up and made her vulnerable. At the same time, her campaign didn't spend nearly enough to promote her. So yeah. That, I think, was a big mistake. Now, yeah. A number of PACs gave smaller, only about $20,000 in PAC money went to support advertising for Gonzalez versus that almost $200,000 for Harrell. And I think that made a big difference.
Yeah. You know, it's anecdotal, but I got maybe one flyer for Gonzalez, and I got at least a dozen that were either pro Harrell or anti Gonzalez.
I got emails for Harrell. I got flyers for Harrell. I got text messages for Harrell. And I got maybe one or two flyers early on in the campaign for Gonzalez. And it really seemed to me like no one was making the case
And the flyers that were pro Harrell as opposed to anti Gonzalez, mm-hmm. they were grossly misleading. I mean, just mm-hmm. jaw droppingly, you know. Harrell is the progressive candidate in the race. No, he's not.
Taking credit for things he didn't do on the council.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
things that the council did over his opposition in some cases.
I know. And Gonzalez didn't lie like Harrell did, thank goodness. But she also didn't make the case for things that she did actually support and work on. And that was, I think, one of the worst aspects of her campaign. Now, in second place for PAC money wasn't Lorena Gonzalez. She's in third place. Her total PAC money was $486,794. In second place was Sarah Nelson. In addition to the attack flyers against Nikita Oliver, Nelson benefited from two additional sources. The National Association of Realtors Fund spent $93,486 on positive flyers and other support for Nelson. And the Seattle Firefighters PAC spent $49,566 to support her. So her total was $503,833 in PAC money, putting her in second place.
And I cannot remember a council race, citywide or district, where that kind of PAC money was involved. Not even some of the Swan races.
Mm-hmm. So if you add that $503,000 to her to her $574,000 to her campaign. She spent well over $1 million to get elected this year. And that's amazing for a city council race, even if it is a citywide race.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in fourth place for PAC money was Ann Davison, benefiting from those attack ads against Nicole Thomas Kennedy to the tune of $359,483. No, very little money was spent. I think I don't think I saw any PAC money spent to support Ann Davison. It was all attack ads against Nicole Thomas Kennedy. And that's why, if those flyers seem so extreme to you and so an attempt to frighten people, it's because that was Ann Davison's only strategy.
Actually, I got
nothing
I got,
that
I,
could be said in her favor, so they had to go after NTK.
Actually, I got three or four flyers that were pro Davison.
Did you?
Mail.
And that must have come from her campaign.
Yeah, and they were all they all highlighted like one entire side of a double sided flyer was all about her endorsements from Christine Gregoire and Gary Locke. Those yeah. were huge because it gave her legitimacy among Democrats.
And that's really and, all that could be said in her favor.
Yeah, and you know, I think Gregoire and Locke have a lot to, yeah. answer for on those endorsements.
I totally agree. Now, fifth in the PAC money race was Nikita Oliver with $111,166 in mostly positive advertising. And she not only did a dang good job with raising money for her campaign, she did a really good job in directing her PAC, the PAC money that was spent in her race to positive advertising rather than attacks against Sarah Nelson. Sixth was Nicole Thomas Kennedy with $25,169 in PAC money, 97% of it critical of Ann Davison. So NTK also engaged in negative advertising, but she didn't have the same resources at all. And yet, look at how well her campaign is doing. So maybe that's something to be said for holding off on the scaremongering and the fear tactics.
And something to be said for the power of grassroots contributors. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this with the Swamp campaigns, where you can counter a whole lot of business money if you have genuine support in the community and can raise money there.
Yeah. And if you remind people of what you've done or what you stand for.
Yeah, because that is enough money to at least be competitive in the races. And then yeah. the rest of it is who you are and what you've done and all the rest of it.
Yeah. So now if as a voter you felt overwhelmed by attack ads, you absolutely were. 72% of all the campaign money spent by PACs and independent expenditure committees involved attack ads, and it was a lot of money. Now, of the positive advertising, the bulk was spent on behalf of Bruce Harrell and Sarah Nelson, with Nikita Oliver a distant third. Okay.
Yeah.
So attack ads make a difference, but so does the positive advertising.
And as with Harold, the positive stuff that I saw for Nelson was grossly misleading.
Yeah.
I mean, really badly misleading. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about how she's progressive and, you know, all the rest of this. And she does not have a progressive bone in her body. She really doesn't. And she doesn't have anything in her history.
I think it's pretty limited to environmental stuff. And and that's about it. Now, in addition to not making a consistent positive case to vote for Gonzalez, her campaign made those two big mistakes. So I think that shows the pitfall for progressive candidates trying to go after their more conservative or quote unquote more moderate Democratic challengers is they'll turn on you. And if they lie to talk about their credentials, they will lie to talk about and criticize your advertising.
Okay. And not only that, but local media, there really isn't any local media left that will hold them accountable for those.
Right.
Lies.
Right.
I mean, the so-called news coverage out of the Seattle Times that was blatantly slanted in favor of Harrell was mm-hmm. really discouraging this year. I mean, they were in the tank for Harrell from the primary.
Yeah.
And it was bad. You know, it used to be that the Strangers endorsements and coverage was highly influential. That has changed with the pandemic and the loss of the paper Stranger. I think, you know, the influence of SOG online is vastly reduced from what it once was. And there really hasn't been anything to replace it, or the Seattle Weekly since its demise. Yeah. There's just no alt weeklies in town that fill that kind of anti-mainstream role at this point.
Yeah. Now I have to say that Nicole Thomas Kennedy has done really well for an underfunded campaign that she really wasn't prepared to run past the primary. I think we look at that race and realize that the folks who engaged in strategic voting to try to knock out Ann Davidson in the primary made a pretty big mistake there. Seattle is a very big city now with a lot of wealthy and upper middle class conservatives, including a lot of tech bros living here. And a lot of the lower income folks have been priced out and have been pushed out of the city limits. So our demographics have changed enough that I don't think you can look at prior elections and try to do strategic voting anymore. And there are a lot of folks who are talking about how, if Pete Holmes had made it through the primary, he would have wiped the floor with Ann Davidson. And I think that's probably true. He would have also gotten a whole lot more funding than Ann Davidson did.
Or Thomas Kennedy for that matter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. It says a lot. And bear in mind that Seattle has added 20% to its population in the last decade. And yes. that does not even count the people who have been priced out of Seattle and have left, have been replaced by new transfers. A lot of those new people are here because of tech jobs. And they're making six figures. And you know, some of them at least can be counted on to vote their economic interests. Some of them are socially liberal or environmentalists or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's why they moved to Seattle to take the tech jobs, as opposed to, say, you know, Boston or some other big city, Austin or wherever. But the demographics have shifted, and the money is now a huge factor in Seattle political races.
And there's a lot of it out there.
And it is a brave new world, as Maria said.
And it didn't, you
know, past performance is no indicator of future success.
Right. And it didn't, a lot of that money didn't come from outside of Seattle either. Bruce Harreld and Sarah Nelson did get a chunk of money from outside, but it wasn't more than, say, 15 to 20% of their campaigns, you know. And of course, PAC money can come from anywhere. Right.
And I think people who support Shama Sawant should be very concerned about the recall election next month.
Yeah.
Because that's already been hugely expensive. It's probably going to top $2 million by the time they're done. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that money is going to be negative for Sawant. And you can count on the Seattle Times to be reflexively anti-Sawant in this coverage. And it's, you know, historically, Sawant has been able to counter that with her armory of volunteers and her ground game and her ability to turn out the late vote. She's going to have to do even more of that this time to be competitive. It's going to be a real uphill climb, I think, for her to keep a council seat.
Yeah, we'll see. And of course, it's only folks who live in District 3 who will be able to vote in that election. So
yeah, and it's only Sawant who's going to be on the ballot. She doesn't have a flawed candidate that people can say, well, I don't really like Shama, but this other person seems worse. That's not going to be an option this time. So, you know, it's just going to be up or down on Sawant and what you think of her. And she, at this point, has the most tenure of any council member, which is just remarkable. But it also means that some people are just going to say it's time for a change.
Yeah.
All right.
But then I think there will be folks who will say, well, if she's not there, then we don't have any representation at all.
Especially with Oliver having lost in her council bid.
Yeah. So we'll see. And District 3 tends to be more progressive than other districts in Seattle, because if you look at the contributions to the progressive candidates by district, a lot of their money came from District 3. So,
however, I would also say that District 3's demographics are shifting also. Mm-hmm. If you see the amount of new buildings that have gone up, for instance, on Capitol Hill, in the last 10 years. That's very, very different than it was when Sawant was first elected. And it means that door knocking is more difficult because you can't get into those buildings easily. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see how that election plays out. Yeah. And of course, we'll talk about it.
We will. So I want to talk a little bit about city budget amendments, okay. particularly the human services. We talked about the council.
That's enough on the election, for God's sake.
Yeah. We talked about the council's public safety amendments last week. And if you think about the city budget in total, I think it breaks down along four lines into four broad categories. Public safety, which is cops, courts, jail, is one. Human services is another. So all of the things that you do for the people, the city of Seattle, elder care, youth programs, food programs, homelessness issues, et cetera. The third category is infrastructure. So things like the Seattle Public Utilities and the Seattle Department of Transportation, the public libraries, et cetera. And the fourth category is the arts. So if you think about the city, and of course there's administration of the city too, but if you think of the city budget in those terms, the second big chunk then after public safety is human services, and some folks would argue it should be the biggest chunk. So first, the Human Services Department, there are 32 amendments to the Human Services Department budget. I think that's the most of just about any department except maybe SDOT, the Department of Transportation. They fall into some broad groups.
And HSD has been so bad in recent years that that's not a surprise.
Yeah.
The city council has been trying to rein them in for years and years now.
Well, I've been trying to kind of shape the human services budget, and then the mayor turns around and doesn't follow the council's guidelines. So once again, the city council is trying to shape the human services budget. And they have some community safety and restorative justice programs. Excuse me. About $25.5 million, including money for several diversion programs, the city council has amendments to add back into the budget. Money for a gun violence study and for a low acuity 9/11 emergency response program. Programs that would receive funding include community passageways, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, Urban Family, Choose 180, and LELO. It includes an amendment to add $14.6 million to expand the LEAD program so it can accept all priority qualified referrals instead of having to turn down about two-thirds of the people who are referred to the program. So that's the biggest chunk of changes to the Human Service Department budget, is that $25.5 million, primarily for diversion programs. The second big chunk is community health and behavioral health programs. There are amendments that would add $16.2 million to the Human Services Department budget, including money for new health facilities and $13.9 million to expand the city's mental and behavioral health system. $8.5 million of that $13.9 million chunk will be used to open a second crisis center, similar to the one currently operated by the Downtown Emergency Services Center. $3.9 million would expand mobile health crisis services, and another $1.5 million would pay for more staff for that new crisis center. This is the city's attempt, I think, to do something with people suffering from mental illness other than warehousing them in jail. It's a real acknowledgement that the county and the state are not spending the money and not doing their jobs under the law to provide adequate mental health facilities and treatment. Okay, so that's the second big chunk. The third big chunk are food programs. So the amendments in the HSD department would add over $10 million for various food programs, particularly money needed for programs that were created in the wake of the COVID-19 lockdown. Those programs will continue to be funded through the end of 2022 if these amendments pass. And then there are a few other miscellaneous amendments, a little over $5 million for child care facilities and improvements, about $3 million for survivors of gender-based violence, $2 million for a youth pre-employment program, and much smaller amounts for things like rental assistance, community facilities, upgrades, programs for seniors, programs for youth, and for Native communities. So those are the changes made to the HSD budget, and they really lean in the direction of diversion programs to continue the community public safety initiatives of the council and behavioral health programs to try to help folks who are living on the street because they have a mental illness or they're struggling with their mental health care. They have trouble getting off the street for that reason. Now, the Office of Housing, the amendments break down in three categories. There are three big amendments for acquisition of affordable housing that would fund something like $70.2 million to acquire more affordable housing, including allowing tenants to purchase their own buildings. That's a big chunk of money, and that's a big change from Mayor Durkan's budget. There is money for permanently supportive housing, $2.8 million to pay for maintenance and operations of new permanently supportive housing for the homeless, and $200,000 to expand the Home for Good program to house homeless folks who are over 50 years old. So that's another change from Durkan's budget. And then there's an amendment for $1.5 million to provide wraparound services for homeless shelters, not what are sometimes termed non-permanent supportive housing. So, again, an acknowledgement that the Office of Housing can be doing more to help get homeless folks off the street and to help stop people from being displaced, tenants from being displaced when a landlord wants to push them out and convert to condos or tear down and build a new building. Okay. In the homelessness response part of the budget, there were 15 amendments. Andrew Lewis, who chairs the Committee on Homelessness, proposed 7 of them, and he had the biggest additions in funding. He would add $19.4 million for a new high-acuity shelter that would have 150 beds and include medical staff, including a doctor and nursing personnel. And this was specifically requested by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, which will manage this new shelter. This is really for people who are suffering physical illness issues on the street and need to get their physical health stabilized. There really isn't any shelter where they can go that can do that. This would provide that shelter where people can get their physical health stabilized before they start thinking about looking for a new job and getting into permanent housing. He has another amendment to add $7.6 million to create a peer navigator system to be run by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. That's another request made by the authority. The peer navigator system are people with lived experience of homelessness who would help, who would be, in addition to case managers, who take on specific tasks to get people into housing and stabilized. The peer navigators have been through the process, and they know how to help people keep from backsliding and falling out of the program. So that's a very important part of the system.
I'm having a difficulty with any part of this bureaucracy that's named navigator or navigation at this point.
I know. I don't think that's going to be the official name of the program, but it's a very important piece of the helping folks get rehoused.
Sure.
He also has an amendment to add $1.9 million to provide services to the two new tiny home villages that opened this year, Rosie's Village and Friendship Heights, and to add behavioral health services, security staff, and case managers to the expansions at Inner Bay Village and Georgetown. So very important money to operate tiny home villages. He would also add $800,000 for COVID-19 relief programs. Okay. He has an amendment adding $700,000 for a workforce development program for homeless youth and $600,000 to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority for additional administrative costs. Now that they're getting up and running, they have some additional costs that need to be covered. Now, other council staff proposed some amendments to the city's homelessness response. Tammy Morales proposed adding $4.1 million to create transitional housing for Native communities, and her co-sponsors were, of course, Deborah Juarez, who always goes to bat for Native communities, and Andrew Lewis, who is the chair of the Homelessness Response Committee on the City Council. Now, there were 2 amendments to add $3.47 million for homeless folks living in their vehicles, including setting up 3 new safe parking lots. Those 2 amendments came from Dan Strauss and Shama Sawant. There are two amendments to add $312,000 to expand day services for the homeless. That's Dan Strauss and Deborah Juarez. Two amendments to add $256,000 for additional outreach and shelter staff. That's from also Dan Strauss and Deborah Juarez. And an amendment to set aside or proviso $9 million in the city's homelessness response for the operation of 13 tiny home villages, including the 8 that are already in operation, plus the 2 new ones opening this year and 3 new ones which are going to be built next year with funding from the state of Washington. The proviso would prevent the King County Regional Homelessness Authority from spending that $9 million on anything else. Mark Dones and some members of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority Board of Operations have said that they don't like and don't want to fund additional tiny home villages. So there's some concern in the city council that they're going to cut off funding for the ones that exist and the ones that are in the planning process to be built next year. This proviso is going to silo that money and protect it from being used for anything else. And I think that's a good thing. Shama Sawant sponsored this amendment with co-sponsors Tammy Morales and Andrew Lewis signing on to it as well. So those are the changes to the city's homelessness response. And it really shows that the city is concerned about shaping how the King County Regional Homelessness Authority Board runs the homelessness response by adding amendments that are for specific things and provisoing that money for tiny home villages. Now, so there are miscellaneous other human needs amendments scattered throughout the rest of the budget. I'll just name about 5 or 6 of those. Gonzalez proposed adding $661,000 to the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs to expand the city's expanded legal defense network for immigrants. Tammy Morales proposed having the Department of Neighborhoods explore options for how to increase community wealth building. Gonzalez proposed setting aside $750,000 in the Department of Neighborhoods to run a pilot guaranteed basic income program. Tammy Morales and Dan Strauss co-sponsored that. So if you're thinking Dan Strauss is not a progressive, you can look to this amendment to give you some idea of what he thinks is a good idea, right? 3 amendments by Tammy Morales in the Department of Education and Early Learning would serve BIPOC youth. There's $1 million for Black girls and young women and Black queer and transgender youth, $2 million for culturally responsive after-school programming, and $450,000 for restorative justice programming. Shama Sawant proposed 2 amendments to the Seattle Department of Construction and Inspections for tenants. One would add $1.5 million to implement the new relocation assistance ordinance that the council passed last year, and the other would provide $500,000 of additional funding for tenant outreach services and implementation of the city's right to counsel for all tenants who are going through the eviction process. So some very important funding there for tenants. And most of the amendments to the Office of Economic Development budget would help small businesses, youth employment, farmers markets, and refugee and immigrant women. And those amendments were added by Tammy Morales, Deborah Juarez, Dan Strauss, and Alex Peterson. So again, a progressive council, even some of the ones that regularly go to bat for business when you look at some of the human needs budget. And it's those amendments are spread across the entire council, and not just 1 or 2.
It's going to be very, very interesting to see if Bruce Harrell honors those amendments should they become part of the budget.
Since
Durkin had a history of ignoring them and spending money on her preferred programs.
Yeah, and even when the city council would proviso funds or say this money can only be spent for a certain purpose, Durkin often just would let the money sit there in the budget and not spend it at all. And that's a dereliction of duty. Now, the next step in the budget process will be this coming Wednesday, the 10th, when Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda releases her balancing package. She's going to take all these different amendments and try to fit as many of them as she can into a revised budget that balances. And she'll release that this coming Wednesday. Then the City Council is going to look at that and start voting on the different pieces. So that's the next step.
All right.
Yeah.
And as you're analysis indicates, you know, with all the different money being spent in different areas, it kind of reinforces why the Chamber of Commerce, on the one hand, it appears to be a lot of money, but in the big picture is a pittance why they buy candidates to get their hands on the levers of what's happening there at City Hall.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is particularly a thorn in their side is in the past, the Office of Economic Development was money spent on behalf of business primarily. And I just mentioned that the amendments that the City Council is making to that would add things that benefit mostly small businesses, young employment for young folks, you know, farmers markets, refugees and immigrant women, you know, the kind of folks that big business don't care about generally.
And that's appropriate because if you look at the businesses that have been wiped out by the pandemic, that's who it's hit the hardest. Yeah. That's who really needs the assistance right now.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, we'll be returning to this inevitably in the next weeks
in
and
the
years
coming
to come.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they should have the whole thing passed by around Thanksgiving. So that's the time.
That's always
we're talking
the goal.
About it this month. Yep.
All right. Tim Iman getting some news this week.
Yeah. Tim Iman has defaulted. People may remember that he was fined $2.6 million by the state earlier this year for what they characterized as willful and repeated violation of campaign finance laws over the years. So he was ordered to repay $2.6 million to the state as restitution for his various crimes, and he has now defaulted on those monthly payments that he was trying to work toward, paying that fine back. So the court is now talking about potentially seizing his home. He's in big trouble. He may be reduced to, you know, auctioning off, his vast collection of office chairs. He's in big trouble. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah.
And it raises the question of, maybe Tim isn't very good at managing money either, since he's really thinking about that government can't, you know.
Yeah, and he has lost the folks who used to support him, who would have likely stepped in and bailed him out in this situation if it had happened about, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. Those folks are either no longer alive or they've ditched his camp. So
yeah.
Even though he has shaped a lot of government spending in this region, he's struggling with his own finances now. And I think also I was kind of interested that Bob Ferguson's office said that and the court judge said that this violation of campaign finance law that Tim Iman has done is the worst they've ever seen. And it's been chronic over the last decade.
They use the word egregious a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, Iman is now branching out. He's trying to get initiatives in 7 different states to address, you know, election fraud. So, you know, grifters are going to grift, and he's trying to get on that bandwagon and raise money from the credulous pro-Trump people in different states who don't understand his background and, you know, what he's about. It's a desperation ploy, I think, on his part.
All right. Well, sticking with the subject of looking for new employment, Carmen Best apparently making the short list in New York.
Yeah, for the New York City Police Department chief position. For anybody who knows anything about New York City, this is kind of a joke because the New York City Police Department's union is extremely powerful. They have a department that has never been able to be controlled by any mayor or any police chief. Best history in Seattle demonstrates that she's not a particularly good administrator. She certainly didn't have control of the 1,300 police department here. So how on earth is she going to control a 40,000 police officer department in New York City? She's not. And that might be the point. Bear in mind that New York City just elected this week a new mayor, Eric Adams, who is a former police officer, and who is not likely to hold NYPD to any kind of accountability. And they may be looking for a chief who's incapable of that as well, in which case Carmen Best might be their person.
Yeah, well, we have
sort of the Murphy's Law of rising to the level of incompetence, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of 3 minutes left. Job, can you touch on national elections, compress that in?
Yeah, and I really wanted to talk about the infrastructure bill that the Democrats passed in Congress.
Well, let's go for that.
$1.2 trillion. It's not what it should be. It is not the larger social spending bill. However, they did get an agreement with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in the Senate. So they have the votes now to pass that in the Senate, in theory, in the next couple of weeks. We'll see what happens with that. This, meantime, is spending more on traditional infrastructure, but it's got a lot of good money in it. It's a game changer in a lot of ways. Money for rail, money for bridges, money for electric vehicle chargers, money for ports and airports, drinking water for places like Flint, Michigan, broadband expansion. That's going to be huge in rural America. Environmental remediation, power and clean energy. So it's got a lot of good things in it. It's not what it should be, but it is still way more than Congress has managed to do really for decades. So that was a big win for Democrats last night. We'll see if they follow up with a social spending bill in the next couple of weeks, but cautiously hopeful on that one as well. And then do we have 60 seconds left for
Yes. election? Yeah, okay. 2 minutes.
Michelle Wu is the new mayor of Boston. She's the first woman and the first person of color. She's a former aide to Elizabeth Warren. So Progressive did win in some elections. Traditional Democrats did not fare so well. Of course, Virginia, we all know about. The New Jersey governor's race was also much closer than it should have been with the incumbent Democrat there. But there were progressives elected to school boards and city councils all across the country, including some big cities like Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Los Angeles. It's a lengthy list. So some encouraging news in national elections that you didn't necessarily hear about in the national coverage that was all focused on Virginia.
All right. And finally, quickly, the UN climate summit, appears to be more of the usual, perhaps increased.
Probably the biggest thing to come out of it is 40 different countries pledging to forsake coal power as a source of energy. Of course, the United States was not one of those. Neither was China, which is the biggest emitter right now of coal power in the world. And we saw this week where coal emissions are now back to their 2019 levels pre-pandemic, which is a very discouraging sign in terms of the climate, that the pandemic suppressed those kind of emissions, but not for long.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that this thing that could threaten the future of humanity, the moderate Democrats can't even get together to make a commitment to move away from coal.
Yeah, that's very discouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be on everybody's tombstone. All right.
And a lot of animals, too, not just humans. Yeah. Yeah.
So leaving you with happy news.
Yeah, as we like to do.
As we like to do.
It's a tradition.
Yes.
All right.
So we'll be back with more happy news next week.
The struggle continues.
Yep.